Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, October the 9th. And our guest this hour wonders, where have all the grown-ups gone? And suggests that our own childishness is our greatest weakness. And we will wonder if you agree or not and what thoughts you have for her at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And please include your first name and your community with your email. Diana West is a syndicated Washington Times columnist whose essays have appeared in many different publications, including the Wall Street Journal and the Weekly Standard. She has also written fiction for the Atlantic Monthly. And her most recent book is The Death of the Grown-Up, How America's Arrested Development is Bringing Down Western Civilization. And she joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning.
And you're also a regular commentator on Lou Dobbs CNN, on CNN, aren't you?
Yes, correct.
Just saw you there last night, in fact.
Yes.
So, when did the grown-up die?
Well, this is something I set out to discover, and I think the conventional wisdom tells us that the grown-up disappeared sometime in the 1960s. But what I discovered in my reading was that this actually took place probably in its most visible incarnation right after World War II in the supposedly Aussie and Harriet halcyon conservative decade of the 1950s.
No, what examples do you have? Why did you see it starting there?
Well, what you have before the war, you have the Depression. You have a period where no one even talked about teenagers because there was no such word until 1941, which I thought was quite striking.
Mm-hmm.
And when young people worked, any money they made went into the family kitty because times were hard. The biggest change in I think really the main factor, there were others, but the biggest change came after World War II in a period of economic boom when kids, now known as teenagers, either worked and pocketed their money or were given an allowance on a scale never before seen in history. And from that grew a youth market. Business suddenly retooled after the war very, very largely to satisfy the new tastes and fantasies of kids, of young people. You see this most strikingly in the rise of rock and roll, for example. And as a result of this new power, I think there is what you could call a transfer of cultural authority from adults to young people, to teens, to early 20s, but mainly the teen group, that really marginalized the cultural power of what we think of now as the greatest generation. They were kind of off the stage fairly quickly in terms of affecting things in the culture very soon after they came home, which kind of startled me, but that's what I concluded.
Yeah. Well, then that greatest generation, my parents in that generation,
mine too. Uh-huh.
Spoiled the baby boomers.
Sure.
And then you see even more evidence of this through the 1960s. Did you call that a generation or a decade long temper tantrum?
Yes. I think that the point of the 60s in relation to what I was just describing, a lot of the sweeping changes that we usually talk about in terms of the 1960s, whether it's sexual liberation, racial desegregation, just general loosenings in terms of language and mores, a lot of these things were underway in the 1950s, which, again, I found so fascinating. We, of course, know about, 1953 was the year of Brown v. Board of Education, which got the desegregation underway in a large, big force for that. But 1953 was also the year that Playboy started publishing. So you have kind of the porno flagship of the sexual revolution getting underway in the 1950s early. You have things like The Pill by 1960. You have Lenny Bruce beating obscenity raps by 1961. What we think of as the 60s really started in 64 with, say, the arrival of the Beatles, the first campus takeovers at Berkeley, the first campus, the very first student rebellion starting in 64 with the so-called free speech movement at Berkeley. So to me, what I ended up seeing the 1960s being all about was really the last grown-up standing were the parents, and a lot of the student rebellion was very much directed against educators, you know, sort of the parent symbol, and parents themselves, the 60s gave us, I think, their enduring legacy really is a new kind of personality, an anti-authority kind of strain that is very often opposed. I call it the mainstreaming of the counterculture in the book, and very often it isn't so much that we are now all countercultural and you know, irresponsible or just you know, always iconoclastic. I think people are responsible and they are paying their mortgage and raising their kids and so on, but they don't want to appear to be doing so. And this was something that actually came to me in the 90s when my husband and I had our kids, and I started seeing in the parents, young parents around us, that nobody really wanted to be seen as an adult, a mister. I had people tell me I'm too young to be mister when they're obviously not. So I think the 60s give us the personality that we still are very much shaped by.
Yeah. Well, you know, can't we be a little bit youth obsessed and not want people to call us ma'am, and still, you know, still be responsible grown-ups?
Well, I don't know. That's my question. I actually think that there's a connection. It's not so much. It doesn't stay just a superficial symbol. I think that there are a lot of attitudes that what I try to show in the book is how they kind of over what we're now looking at, you know, 50 years, 50 plus years since this period I'm talking about, of coming up on 60, really, if you go back to 1950, permeates us across society. And I think the childishness or the cult of youth, the notion that we are not responsible really, has affected us in very serious ways, and now kind of paralyze us in terms of facing harsh realities, talking about things forthrightly. I mean, speech codes, political correctness, fear seem to me to be part of this sort of childish world of pretend that I think our adult population really inhabits. I live in Washington, and I can't tell you how deeply I feel this around me, people who are afraid to speak out, people afraid to talk about things, and I really think it comes from kind of a failure to develop. We've become very, I think part of the whole, if you look at kind of my notion of leveling of adult authority, I think this is mirrored in kind of the whole trend to level cultural authority as well, whereby no longer do we consider Western civilization to be a gift to the world, but rather one culture among many, many others, none of whom have given anything better than another, no freedom, no liberty, etc. And we see the culture wars come out of that, so-called culture wars in the 80s and 90s, from which sort of the Western canon people lost, the multiculturalists won. And now that we are in what I call in the book a real culture war, it seems very hard for people to figure out who they are, what they want to protect, what is, you know, Western civilization, where do we defend it, how do we even know what it is. And when we come up against a society coming out of Islam that is very much antithetical to the sorts of liberties that come out of Western culture, we don't know how to talk about it. We don't know how to figure out how to preserve it. And I think it's very dangerous, which is why I have the subtitle about bringing down Western civilization.
Right. I mean, I was going to get into that as like one thing to have maybe looser sexual morals or you know, wanting to have a lot of fun and playing air guitar, and how that leads to the downfall of Western civilization.
Well, this is the thing. If you kind of go along with my theory to the point of accepting that there is a reluctance to go to maturity and getting to that notion of sort of leveling of authority, I think that where you end up with it being trouble is that we are now in a, it's like this adolescent mindset, which again is not allowing sort of a notion that there's anything special about our civilization. You are coming up against this other civilization, Islam, that actually demands the kind of censorship that we have willingly imposed on ourselves. So if we have this sort of here's the thing. where I find, I actually was giving a talk at a bookstore in Washington that's it's known as a fairly liberal kind of bookstore. And somebody was listening to my talk and said, "Are you saying that multiculturalism is juvenile?" And I had to say, yes, because it requires a learned non-judgmentalism in order to actually sort of support the notion that a culture that brings liberty to people, that brings religious freedom to people, that brings prosperity to more people than other systems have brought before, is not truly better than other sorts of systems, communism, tribal culture, etc. In order to actually go along with that, which is what we've been inculcating in our kids now for a generation or two, you have to suspend your judgment, your subjectivity. This I find to be very infantilizing. It is an infantile thing not to exercise your faculties of logic. So when you actually come up as a result, in other words, we censor ourselves. We have all these speech codes. When you actually come up against another system, Islam, which demands censorship as a point of religious law, you are not allowed to criticize Islam, for example, for anything, repression of women, lack of religious freedom, whatever it is, you're not allowed to do it. It's against the religious law. When you come up against that as a self-censoring society, you come up against a society that demands censorship, I think you're in trouble because you no longer have the tools or the courage to speak out, to try to defend yourself or defend your principles of religious liberty, for example, or women's rights. These are serious issues, and it's no longer just a matter of air guitar or, you know, wanting to wear blue jeans. It permeates. You can't just have a surface without seeing changes go through you as a national personality.
Our guest, that's where I see the danger. Our guest is Diana West. She is the author of the new book, The Death of the Grown-Up, How America's Arrested Development is Bringing Down Western Civilization. Do you buy this? What questions do you have? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you along. Hope you stay tuned. Coming up a little later today, it's At Issue with Ben Marins between 4 and 6, where Ben and his guests will be talking about current issues of the day. Wisconsin Public Radio needs volunteers to answer phones here in Madison at Vilas Hall during our upcoming membership drive. The pledge drive, that's right, the pledge drive starts on Thursday, and it runs for about a week and a couple of days. If you would like to help out, answer phones, meet with many of you, the hosts who are here, depending on the time you're here, and meet other volunteers like you, visit our website at wpr.org/volunteer, or you can call 608-263-2564, 608-263-2564, to find out the times we need you to volunteer during our upcoming membership drive here at Wisconsin Public Radio. Hope to see you in the next week or so. We are talking with Diana West. She is a syndicated columnist with the Washington Times, and she is the author of the new book, The Death of the Grown-Up, How America's Arrested Development is Bringing Down Western Civilization. She says that too many of us Americans are youth-obsessed, and we don't know right from wrong, and we are stuck in a state of adolescence where we can't say no. It's developed a generation of permissive parents, teachers, government officials. And she says, no wonder we can't stop Islamic terrorism. We haven't put down our toys yet. So, what do you think? 1-800-642-1234 or 263-1890. Our lines are full at the moment. Dimitri in Kenosha is with us first. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for having this wonderful program. My question for Diana West is to clarify her definition of maturity, because am I understanding you correctly, Ms. West, is that your definition of maturity is to ability to make judgment.
Yes, I would say making judgments is part of it. Yes, I think there's also a set of virtues that people try to live by: honor, duty, loyalty, whatever the current Boy Scout creed probably has a lot of those that we try to uphold. I think it's also about not trying to remain 17. Adulthood can have many definitions. I would be the first to say, but there certainly is. It's certainly not about remaining eternally 17. There was a very interesting professor, Lionel Trilling, well-known professor from Columbia University, who in the middle of, right after Columbia had gone through its student rebellions, understood that what the students were all about was kind of throwing over the notion of what he called, Trilling, making a life with a beginning, a middle, and an end, which he was an English professor, and he said, you know, this is what all great literature was really about, you know, if you think of David Copperfield on up or down. The notion that there are limits, there do become limits to life as you make choices. I think one thing, we reject that notion. It is limiting. There is a sense of mortality involved in it. But I think it is an adjustment that I think we reject now that does lead to many of these sorts of problems that I try to write about in the book.
May I follow up on that?
Yes, of course.
The reason I ask is I was wanting for you to differentiate between the ability to make judgment itself and a commitment on the part of a person to make competent judgment based on logic and research and all those things that actually do define us as an adult. In my line of profession, I'm a teacher on the college level. I do deal with students who are of young age who, in my experience, have absolutely no problem voicing judgment. However, where they often do make mistakes is the next step, which is to evaluate the kind of judgments that we make. And I saw a reluctance on your part to make that distinction between judging competently and interest in judging itself in your discussion of multiculturalism, because, like I said, we often do make all kinds of judgments, but it is a particular kind of judgment, judging groups of people, judging their interests, judging their values, that seems to drive more to the core of the issue.
Well, I'm not sure I understand the distinction, because of course to me, judgment involves research, reflection, and so on. So I would not disagree with your definition, and I don't make a distinction.
No, Diana West, is it your contention that conservatives are grown-ups and liberals are adolescents?
No, absolutely not. In fact, if you go through my book, I think the politician who comes under some of the greatest criticism is President Bush. No, this is not a political statement. I think we are all creatures of our time, and I think that conservatives are just as culpable as liberals or independents. I don't think this speaks to a part of the political spectrum. No.
All right. Chris in Blue Mounds, you're on the air.
Hi. I've maybe missed a little bit while on hold, but I just wanted to respond to an earlier comment about how multiculturalism perhaps suggested a juvenile juvenile position. Mm-hmm. And I'm a little bit confused about that, because I see the globalization of, I guess, U.S. corporate interests as being all about multiculturalism, being able to translate brands and products, and that really is the future of corporate markets overseas. So isn't that our future position, our future strength?
I don't know. I actually have problems with that global corporate notion. I don't know that that's our future. I don't think that's quite sorted out, really. I mean, it certainly is our present. But who knows what the future brings? It it's it certainly would feed into what you're talking about, but it's something that I would argue against, for different reasons we can go into. But I don't think that's an inevitability, and that doesn't necessarily justify it.
Chris, thank you. Ed in Madison is with us now. Hi, Ed.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to affirm the notion that the inability to make distinctions and judgments between cultures as to what is really valuable or what may actually be good, that just seems right to me that is taking away of almost a moral logic, and that is, as a parent of young children, that is a juvenile deficiency that you have to develop in children. But I also wanted to explore with Diana, maybe before the 60s, what you see being some of the roots that have led us into the 60s in that period and where we are now.
Yes, well, I mentioned earlier that the affluence in and affluence in the or money in the hands of children and teenagers changed things dramatically. All of a sudden, the media culture, which of course was growing by leaps and bounds from primarily a movie culture and becoming even more of a music culture, this changed the whole balance of the adult versus the child. I was really struck. There was an interesting anecdote from a book called Teenagers. I believe she may be a Wisconsin professor by, I'm blanking on her name at the moment, but anyhow, I'll try to remember it, where this writer who wrote about a history of American teenagers noticed that at a Frank Sinatra, Tommy Dorsey concert, I guess in the mid-40s, at a certain point, the audience, which was of teens and adults, the kids were getting a little rowdy, and Frank Sinatra said something like, "Settle down, there are other folks in the house," meaning the adults who'd come to see a show and didn't want to hear a lot of noise. If you flash forward to the 1950s, what you saw coming out of the ink-stained wretches writing at the industry trade publications like Variety and Music Box and so on was their absolute amazement at what happened in the concert halls now. It was pandemonium. We all know the stories of, the kids swooning over the various rock acts. Frank Sinatra, of course, did have a lot to do with that earlier, but you have a complete homogeneous teenage crowd in the 1950s at the concert halls. It was like the adults had disappeared. And so this, again, reoriented the pop scene to kids. You had also a new sexuality coming across the airwaves in a very mainstream way. This was something else that was very different. It wasn't like any of these things, bad language, loose mores, what have you, didn't exist all across the centuries. But in traditional periods, meaning everything really before, say, 1950, we have margins. We have a mainstream that was fairly clean. We had margins where you could find more exotic or less savory, or however you want to term it, products, acts, literature, music, what have you. And this is, again, something that I found it very interesting when I went back and read some of the old Variety music reviews. They noticed this. The mainstream was changing. And this actually was a topic of heated debate, even in the Congress, which is kind of fascinating. And a lot of the entertainment industry was on the side of keeping the mainstream clean. Now, this again flipped by the 1960s, and I go through that in some detail in the books. I found it quite fascinating. Mm-hmm. But these are some of the strains that were changing us. And again, I think it really had to do with money. It had to do with corporate profits and all of that. Became very hard to say no. But another big change was, and this was something, if you look at the 1920s, when you have the early Hollywood movie industry beginning, and there were quite a number of sexual scandals and so on involving the movie community out in Hollywood, which is where I'm from, the movie industry noticed that there were, in the mid-20s, about 100 Hollywood censorship bills in various legislatures across local legislatures across the country. They were contemplating banning Hollywood movies because they didn't like what was coming out of Hollywood, the manners and mores changing. And the Hollywood movie industry said, we better clean up our act. This is amazing. This is sort of responding to a counterbalance in the culture, sort of the mainstream moral majority, whatever you want to call it. By the 1950s, when the Hollywood writers were noted, the variety writers were noticing these changes coming out of the music industry, there was no counterbalance any longer. There was no clamor to clean up rock and roll lyrics, for example. And so, of course, the industry didn't respond because people had changed by then. Manners and mores had changed. It became part of the mainstream. And so I think that's a very key comparison. And again, I think it has to do with this general loosening that just has happened over time, where you did no longer have what I call in the book the babbitry, the you know, after Sinclair Lewis's send-up of the Rotary Club, you no longer had that bastion of middle-class morality, which could be extremely frustrating to live with if you were a bohemian or unconventional in some way, or it might drive you off to create great art. I don't know. We have a lot of great art created because of the rebellions against manners and mores. But now there's really no tension in that way. We do accommodate almost everything. And so, again, these are some of the changes that really shifted us away from what has been traditional, what has been, you know, the normal course of things. And I think we're into a very different kind of human development. Yes. But it's fairly recent, which I think is very interesting and sort of open for debate and analysis.
Thanks to Ed. Clyde in Cedarburg is with us next. Hi, Clyde.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking a call. I find that this the argument and discussion to be extremely distracting and substantially irrelevant.
Why?
Why did you call?
Yeah.
To the subject. I think I'll illustrate just with one example.
The bringing up of the
representation of the free speech movement at the University of California as being an early representation or an early representation of the syndrome that your guest is speaking about. That is of the revolution, the cultural revolution of the 60s. Actually, she described it as the so-called free speech movement, and it was that in itself was a reaction of students on a campus of an American university to an attempt by the authorities at the university to repress and suppress participation by the students in the very relevant and very and substantial civil rights movement, which is an attempt to bring all Americans into the democratic process. Mm-hmm. The attempt to suppress it resulted in a protest that was called the free speech movement.
Yeah. Diana West?
Oh, you know, I don't know if we want to get off into
it. We don't have to go into specific, but how about this free speech movement, and it was a good thing, and that this was, you know, this was good for civil rights and good for our democracy.
When you have the right to vote, I don't believe insurrection is appropriate. When you have the right to speak, when you have the right to mount political campaigns, this kind of thing became street theater. It became self-indulgence. You had people destroy. I mean, the student movements is nothing moral to defend. We have people destroying things, destroying property, taking professors' work and destroying it, cutting fire hoses, throwing bricks at people. We had a situation at one of the campuses where a policeman was paralyzed from paving stones. This was acting out. This is a free country. It remains a free country. This notion, this romanticization of the student movements, I think, is part of this symptomatic of this childishness. So I will not. I don't accept the caller's portrayal of this. And plus, I find the notion of calling anything irrelevant or distracting because someone has a different point of view to be very odd. I don't mind him having a different opinion from me, but to tell me that I'm distracting or irrelevant because I don't go lockstep with his point of view, I find very odd.
Yeah, Clyde.
Yes. Well, thank you. I think. Your guest just said it all. I think her reaction to my correction and just providing a historical perspective to the actual free speech movement and why it occurred and then to completely mischaracterize it as having to do with paving stones being thrown and all that kind of action. That's interesting too. So I think your callers are able to judge and compare her reaction.
Yeah. Well, Diana West, let me broaden this a little bit more. What what's the antidote to the death of the grown up? What do you propose to fix this?
Well, it really comes about. I mean, I don't know. I do not know exactly what can fix this or whether this can be fixed. We are in. If you look at where we are in our political debate, we are in a very sad state. People are afraid to speak out. We've got this situation really where the war on terror has lost sight of the real problem in the world at this point, in the Western world at this point, which is Islamization. Islamization involves the spread of Islamic law, which is very much antithetical to our liberties. No politician on the left, on the right, in the middle, will say that. Will even ask the question, will even discuss the word Sharia, which of course means Islamic law. We are headed into a very difficult period, I'm afraid. You see Europe's Islamization well advanced, and again, people are afraid to speak out. It's a very difficult period. Now, my only antidote would be to try to speak out, to try to educate ourselves, to not be cowed. And again, I think some of this goes, you know, my metaphor is the grown-up. There are many ways to sort of discuss this, but it does strike me as people who do not develop their faculties of logic and try to actually speak without constantly being afraid of saying the wrong thing. I mean, I would imagine, I don't know, but I would imagine that you as a radio host must remain fairly conscious, not just of using, you know, improper grammar or a slang word or something. You have to sort of keep in mind, you know, what is acceptable, what is not. It's as a columnist, I find that to be also, you know, something that occurs very frequently. But I think people should be more courageous in discussing things. We had a situation in Washington this past week. President Bush hosted his annual post 9/11 iftar dinner. It's a Ramadan fast-breaking dinner, whereby he invited many representatives from different Muslim countries that do nothing but uphold all kinds of repressions on women, on religious tolerance, religious freedom, just to name a couple. He in his speech, once again, he gave another peroration about how the West and Islam both prize religious liberty. This is absolute nonsense. But it's, again, what's going on in official Washington. The same week, the great woman, Hirsi Ali, Muslim apostate, former Dutch parliamentarian, had to leave Washington because she no longer had sufficient security. She's a well-known writer and very outspoken against the repression of women under Islam. She, the very week President Bush is sort of, you know, having over to dinner and praising the very repressors, Hirsi Ali has tried to be very brave and speak against, she has to leave the country because she can't, you know, she has death threats against her. It's a very bad situation. So again, it just requires people to sort of take their responsibility, learn about these things, and see where we go from there. I mean, I think that's the most elemental kind of redress to this situation.
Our guest is Diana West. She is the author of the book, The Death of the Grown-Up, How America's Arrested Development is Bringing Down Western Civilization. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock. A new project that embeds university professors with military units in Iraq and Afghanistan has drawn fierce criticism from the academic community. After 9, Kathleen Dunn will talk with guests on both sides of this issue. That's coming up in our next hour. We're wondering this hour with our guest, where have all the grown-ups gone? Diana West is the author of the book, The Death of the Grown-Up. And our next caller is Jim in Superior. Hi, Jim, you're on the air.
Hello. Something I've noticed over the last several years, the way people raise their kids, different from I was raised and the way I raised my kids, it seems like parents want to be their kids' friends instead of being the adult. I'll take any comment off the air. Yeah. Thank you.
You agree with that, Diana West?
Yes, that's very perceptive. Yes, I do. It's very interesting when you look back at. I had a friend who does a lot of statistics, and I asked her to come up with some statistics for me on kids' attitudes toward their parents nowadays. And it was very interesting. There is very little friction between youngsters and their parents in these polls. And when we think back, you know, in more, say, to the so-called generation gap, what we think of as a generation gap, there was a great deal of friction. And I think that the caller is exactly right. There is a expectation that parents are now friends, buddies, rather than parents, authority figures. And this can be, you know, very pleasant when both parent and child tend to have the same musical taste, they dress alike, but again, there also can be, you know, the sorts of symptoms I discuss in the book that come from this. It's. I think that what we see are children sort of being boosted into a period of adolescence very early, and you see parents who are not really quite leaving adolescence, and so there is a lot of that camaraderie that the caller sees.
Mm-hmm. For instance, there's this little quiz that came along with the material with your book on Are You a Grown-Up? And one of the questions was, it's Halloween time, which it almost is, and your daughter wants to go dressed up as Britney Spears. Your daughter is 12 years old, and what would you say? Would that be, oh, that would be adorable, or B, honey, are you sure you don't want to be a princess or something, or C, no? And your answer is that most people are afraid to say no.
Are afraid to say no, mm-hmm. Yes. I think that there's either they don't understand why it's not great to sexualize your 12-year-old girl because the culture says it's okay. I think there's a conformity mm-hmm. that actually when you don't want to have a sexualized 12-year-old, mm-hmm. you are fighting. And I say that as a mother of two girls
mm-hmm.
Who are 14. I have 14-year-old twins. You are fighting it because that is the prevalent, okay, accepted conformity at this point. And when you do fear that sort of acceleration and display of sexuality in a young kid, you are generally cowed by what's going on with the other girls. The anthropologist Margaret Mead had a very telling quote I found from about 1949 when she said, you know something's different in the culture when the mothers say, what are the other girls doing, mm. dot, 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 rather than when I was a girl, we X, Y, Z. There is a transfer again of this authority to the peer group. What are the other girls doing? Very often that's how mothers decide all kinds of things. Or allow things to be decided. I think the phenomenon of spring break is another place mm-hmm. where parents are very often railroaded into allowing their kids to go off, you know, out of the country to incredible vacations where there's all kinds of alcohol, drugs, sex going on. You know, there have been a lot of horror stories and very sad incidents connected to these incredible vacations. They're expensive too. It always amazes mm-hmm. me that they can even gin up the money. But this sort of, what are the other kids doing? Well, I have to say yes. And you're talking about minors who are in your house. You have to pay for them, and you're still responsible for them. They're not adults yet. They can't go out on their own. And yet their peer group is making this decision fueled by the fantasies on MTV, etc.
Another caller, Mark in Sheboygan. Hi, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I am not really buying her premise on the adults on charge by age. I'm definitely an adult. But shortly after 9/11, I remember the right, I'm not sure who it was on the right, but with the Bush administration in power, saying, aren't you glad the adults are in charge? And as I look around now, 5, 6, 7 years later, I'm not real happy that the so-called adults were in charge.
I don't think they're adults. I said at one point, I do not find this to be a conservatives or adults, liberals or children at all, and that's very much not the message of my book.
I think what you really need to be concerned with is raising your kids by example. You don't have to be your friend. You don't have to be an authoritarian parent. You have to lead by example, and you do have to teach them how to think critically. And the basically, I think the biggest threat for all age groups in America is the incessant marketing of every material good that mm-hmm. can possibly be manufactured
and yes.
crammed down our throats.
I agree with you entirely, and that's another... Look, I would say that another factor in our infantilization is, say, cheap trinkets from China. You know, we've got a situation where we all tend to buy these inexpensive things that now turn out to be poisonous, which I was actually quite pleased because it gives people a real gut check on that, while China is increasing its military to incredible heights. So again, I think that there is a very short-sightedness that definitely, it's like a little kid. A little kid likes things, and I think that as chronological adults, our culture likes things too much. We are too happy to buy, and things are very inexpensive, and you end up, one of the callers talked about the global economy. You end up buying goods from countries that, you know, do not have safeguards, environmental safeguards, insurance, health insurance, good working conditions, and so on, and we just buy it cheaply. We crowd out our own industry because it doesn't succeed in the marketplace any longer, and yet we're contributing to all these terrible problems for I think, a very childish and short-sightedness.
Yeah. I got an email from Angie in Eau Claire who wonders if there are any public figures that you would characterize as adults, or are we all, in a general sense, these adolescents?
Well, that's a very good question, and you know, I was thinking about that today because what you mentioned, I was on Lou Dobbs last night, mm-hmm. and there was a guest on the show. I think his name was Frank Marola, and he is a county clerk from Rensselaer County, New York, and he has just gotten a directive from the governor of New York telling him that he must give driver's licenses to illegal aliens. And Frank believes that, he has read the federal law, and he believes he would be acting against the law to do this. And he also believes that this would also lead to an illegal driver's license, or an illegal alien having a driver's license, of course, leads to, very often, to voting rights and all sorts of other citizen privileges. He has decided to say no. He is right now in kind of open rebellion against the governor of the state. He is a county employee. He is not a state employee. And I'm not sure legally where this will go, but he and 12 other county clerks have said no. To me, I was in awe of him. This, to me, strikes me as a very grown-up thing to do. And in a way, a lot of my book is really about sort of looking where the lines, the boundaries to behavior, the lines on our... our desires have gone. And this I would extend even to a border situation. I think there's a metaphor that takes us all the way through. I would say that Frank Marola is a grown-up. I would say that people who draw the line and do not believe that just eternal openness is what preserves tolerance. If you are open to intolerance, you are no longer going to have a tolerant society. And again, it takes drawing a line. And that would be an example of a grown-up to me.
John in Viroqua is with us now. Hi, John.
Hi. It's interesting, the last statement, actually. What I was going to say is that our nation really was born on the idea of radical reform and radical freedom. I mean, we had the ultimate big daddy figure, and the ultimate authority figure was the king. We had a bunch of very smart, very well-educated, highly revolutionary people that said, "Hey, we are going to revolt. We're going to suspend judgment here. We're going to say we're going to create this radical statement of the First Amendment that says we will support no religion over any other religion, exactly so that all religions can have a chance to flourish." It wasn't that we're going to say ours is better and we're going to do it this way now because we've been repressed before. We're saying we've been repressed before. Therefore, we're going to create freedom for all religions. We're not going to judge any one as better than another. And that was a completely radical thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And
it was a grown-up thing to do.
But it's inimical to much of what you're saying, because you're conflating. You're saying you like it on one hand, but on the other hand, you're saying you don't like it. Like, you're saying you like Marola for saying no, but on the other hand, if you had a preacher that said, "We're going to marry gay people because we think that's wrong," I'm not sure that you would see that as grown up.
Marola is trying to defend the polity against rampant illegality and chaos. When you talk about religious freedom and being open to religions, I'm all for that, except in the case of a religion that does not allow freedom. I mean, I assume you're talking about my statements about the Islamic mm-hmm. law. When you have a religion that is actually conjoins religion with politics and has very specific repressive laws attached to the politics and religion, it is no longer just let all religions flourish. You have a force that is actually designed to put other religions under its authority. And that is where you end up with problems. So unless you want to talk about it, which almost all politicians are afraid to do, it is just going to happen, which is, again, if you look to Europe, we should all be looking to Europe to see what is happening in the great cities of Europe, where you have Sharia courts operating. They're de facto courts, but they do operate and regulate a lot of Muslim family law. In almost every city in England has such a court, where you look to France, to Belgium, to Holland, where you're seeing speech codes and all kinds of infringements on the public square by religious laws that were not there before that they're specifically Islamic. You have to wonder about the whole notion of being open to everything, including intolerance. That's my question.
One last caller in here on that note, on that very subject, John in Appleton.
What I hear is that our parents were wrong. There is a monster under the bed, and its name is Islam. Children don't lack, and they're being able to judge. What they lack is a broader perspective on the wider world. And, yeah, we sent our children overseas for travel and broadened them out. And I think our guest could use a little of that herself. She might see that under the Ottomans, there were mosques next to Orthodox churches.
The churches had to pay taxes. The people lived in various stages of humiliation. This is a big phony as far as what we would like. This is not a model for the West. This is not a model for religious freedom. And that's just historical fact. You say it's a monster under the bed. Well, I find having no rights as a woman to be a monster, not just under the bed, but in the room. I find not having religious freedom, the freedom to leave Islam without having a death sentence. Apostates are under death sentences, even in this age. These are not just monsters, imaginary monsters. These are realities. In Afghanistan, where we actually helped engineer the Constitution, Islamic law is supreme, and we actually had a situation, if you remember, I think it was last year, where a man who had left Islam and become a Christian could no longer stay in American-supported Afghanistan and had to be whisked out of the country to save his life.
We're going to have to leave it there because we're at the end of the hour.
Oh, I understand.
Diana
I'm sorry.
West.
Yeah.
No. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you. It was very entertaining.
Yeah, Diana West, author of The Death of the Grown-Up, thanks to Carmen Jackson and Karen Prager and Leo Duran for producing the hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is The Ideas Network.